in pursuit of golf's holy grail.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thanks for joining me for another Golf Smarter podcast. Just recently, I received an email from David Sucher, who listens to the Golf Smarter podcast in Seattle. He suggested that I try to get in touch with a blogger. Now, come on, we talk to golf professionals and architects and authors, but a blogger who set out an admirable goal of playing all of the top 100 courses in the world based on the 2003 rankings. His entertaining blog is part travelogue, social commentary, and golf course critique. And since he's stopped traveling for the winter months, I thought it'd be fun to talk about his adventures. So, now I would usually start by welcoming our guest and saying their name, but I'm not really sure that I'm even supposed to say your name. So what I think I'll do is we'll give you a name that nobody knows if it's your real name or not. So I'm just going to go generic here and say, welcome, Joe.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, that's great. So you got this wacky idea in your head. Where did the idea come from of playing the top 100 golf courses in the world?
It actually came out of a gift that I got a couple of years ago from a friend, which was actually a plaque. Golf Magazine rates the top golf courses in the world every 2 years. And I had traveled frequently over the years with a group of friends. Every year we had gone to either Ireland or Scotland to play during the summer, different courses. And this friend gave me this plaque, which is actually a walnut plaque that you stick these little pegs into after you've played the course. And ever since then, what happened to be just a hobby and a vacation has sort of turned into an obsession where I now sit and look at the plaque at different times throughout the day and plot how I'm going to get on and play some of the world's top courses.
Well, first of all, it's a generous gift. Do you travel to these courses by yourself or do you go with a friend?
No, typically for the ones overseas, so there's, I believe, 23 courses in the British Isles collectively. So we've been going about 8 years now, a group of friends, either between four or eight of us go on these trips. But then I travel a lot extensively for my day job, and I found that, you know, playing the courses in the United States has been a good way to, when I'm in a city and have some extra time and can arrange a game, can try to get on some of the courses that are in the United States.
Oh, well, if you can work it around your job, that's a great thing. I was going to ask you, do you have a spouse, and is your spouse supportive of you doing this crazy?
She's very supportive of me doing this. I couldn't do it without her.
Let's hear it for spouses.
I have an interesting story. Her family comes over each year for the holidays, and she has a lot of brothers, and they all have a lot of kids. So this last holiday, Thanksgiving, we had something like 20 people over our house for a week, and she actually let me go away for 5 days during that week to go play one of the courses that I've always wanted to play, where she had no interest in going, which is in Durban in South Africa. So she's very accommodating, and couldn't do it without her.
I'd say that's very accommodating. When family's coming over, do you not get along with the family or something?
They're delightful people. It's just 20 people in your house for a week is a bit much.
Oh, come on, Joe. She's not going to be listening to this. What's the real deal here? We know what it's like with in-laws.
Especially my mother-in-law.
Yeah, right. Oh, the mother-in-law story. Okay, yeah. Yeah, really supportive. Okay. South Africa. You got to go to South Africa. Wow. Okay, so what part of the country do you live in?
I live on the east coast of the United States. Which is good, actually, because if you look at the particular list that I'm trying to play, within a couple hours' drive of where I live, I can play 26 courses without having to get on a plane. So geographically, it's actually the best place in the world to live if you're trying to undertake this quest and play these courses.
Is there a prejudice towards the East Coast as far as these selections are made?
I think there's actually a prejudice toward the United States. If you look at the raiders, Golf Magazine does publish a list of the raiders. It's about 50 different individuals. I think because a lot of them are based in the United States, you tend to get a bias on U.S. courses. For instance, Canada has some really spectacular golf courses, but only has two courses on the list. So, yes, I do think that there's actually a bias toward certainly United States courses. I don't know so much the East Coast. I think there just happens to be a lot of good courses. Aside from the East Coast, California has, I believe, eight specific courses that are on the list as well. So really, it's more U.S.-centric than anything, I would say.
And you started this quest when?
Formally, I started it 2 years ago when I got the pegboard from Golf Magazine. Informally, I mean, I had played some of the courses as long as maybe 10 years ago on various trips. But it's only once you actually get the list and start to map out which ones you want to play that I got serious about it 2 years ago.
And the courses that you played 10 years ago, do you go, okay, I played that, I can check that off the list?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay. Yep. All right, so it could have been any time. And you, I personally like to play a course that I've never played before, and yet there are people who just want to play their course over and over and over. You're comfortable with playing courses you're unfamiliar with?
Yeah, because you're playing the top golf courses in the world, typically in locations that are world-class. So, for instance, the course Sand Hills in Nebraska. I probably wouldn't go to Nebraska otherwise but to play this course. And turns out Sand Hills on the particular list that I'm playing is ranked number 11 in the world. It was built in 1995 by Kaur and Crenshaw. Turns out to be one of the most beautiful places in the country. And just every single hole is a spectacular golf hole where you walk up to the tee box and your jaw drops open. So I mean, I like to play my home course as well, and I could see how people would want to do that, but it really helps to expand your horizons. And as I said, I do travel a fair amount anyhow, so as I'm on the road, it gives me something to do as well.
Well, you're a perfect person to ask this question. If you could share with us or give us a tip on how to prepare for a course that you've never played before.
Mm-hmm. Good question. What I would say is a couple things. First, if you can take a caddy, I would always take a caddy. The courses that I'm playing generally either public or private. Since you've never played it before, a caddy can usually be very helpful in terms of where to hit your shots and what types of clubs to use. In the absence of that, I would say the best way to approach it is to just not get too greedy, not to necessarily get up to every hole, try to hit driver, try to kill the ball, but just be smart about it, to look at what the course is going to give you. I mean, in many of these courses are quite difficult and quite challenging, so hitting an iron off of a tee where you've got a narrow fairway is sometimes an intelligent thing to do. But usually it's you know, either listen to the member you're going to play with, you know, take some advice from them on what to do, or sometimes even ask the professional before you go out, go into the pro shop, ask the pro. So, for instance, a course like Inverness in Ohio, I think probably has the smallest green that I've ever played on any of these courses. A course like that, you know, asking the pro beforehand, what do you recommend? He'll give you a little tip about, well, make sure you're not long or, you know, hit up in front of these greens and then chip on to them if you can't get on. Those types of things, I would say, you'd have to play it intelligently. Most of the courses, you can't just get up and hit driver and wedge. You know, they're very hard, very good courses. You have to use a little more imagination.
Well, thank you for promoting Golf Smarter in there. I heard you say you have to golf smarter.
That's right. You do.
Are you a student of golf architecture?
Informally, I am. I would say yes. One of the things that I noticed, I have a copy of Tom Doak's book, A Confidential Guide to Golf. Tom's a very influential architect, designed Pacific Dunes out in Bandon, Oregon. He went through years ago and traveled around the world and played a lot of courses and sort of as he was studying to become an architect. So I refer to his book quite a bit, and have spent a lot of time just as I'm researching, playing these courses. Oftentimes I'll buy the club history when I go to the course. And so I would say informally, I've done quite a bit of research in terms of architecture and design.
Do you find that you play, let's just go ahead and say, a Donald Ross course, and when you go to a different Donald Ross course, you go, this looks familiar, or yeah, I know how he's trying to create my shots here. Do you use that information from architect to architect?
Ross is a good example. I mean, on his courses in particular, you see a lot of similarities on the green. So Pinehurst is the classic example of that, where you've got the bowl type of greens. But what's also interesting is Ross grew up in Scotland in a town called Dornoch, which is up in the Scottish Highlands. And Royal Dornoch is one of the top 25 courses in the world. And when you play Dornoch, you can actually really see where Ross learned that style from playing Dornoch. A lot of the greens are of that shape. I would say Donald Ross would definitely fit into that category. The other course that you can tell right away is the Tillinghast course, in particular the way he does his bunkering. He studied a lot about how to use bunkering to do illusions and so forth. So when you get up in the Tillinghast course, you can definitely see that he makes you hit toward the bunkers and you have to adjust from that. The one that I found to be so far impossible is Alistair McKenzie, even though you know McKenzie. And his courses, his greens are so severe, and the undulations are so wild that even though you know it, there's nothing you can do about it. So I found his so far have been particularly difficult and haven't figured out how to adjust to his. Although by the time I play Augusta, which he co-designed, I'm sure I'll have it figured out.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you will. What's your handicap?
15.
Okay. So do you play courses and when you're done, you say, oh, I want to play this one again. I need another shot at this.
Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. There's been, I would say, a half dozen or so courses where you want to walk immediately from the 18th green back to the first tee because they're so good. In other instances, you're sort of wondering why the course was put on the list at all. And most of the time, you can really understand why it's a great course and see why it's ranked where it is. But I would say only in, maybe 10% of the courses so far, you're blown away and really understand why it's such a great course and want to go out and play it over and over again.
Now, professionally, you're not a golf journalist, are you?
I am not, no.
Can I ask what you do professionally?
Nope. Other than to say that I travel a lot. And the reason I do this anonymously is if you look at, the golf magazines and everything you read about courses, I think a lot of it is biased, honestly, because oftentimes the course will pay to have a journalist come out. They'll pay for their airfare or hotel or they'll comp them. And what I wanted to do with the blog was to really just give an honest opinion. You don't have to like every course. Some courses are overrated or some courses just aren't that good. So I wanted to really be free to write what I wanted. And I was doing it, anonymously because if I've got clients or colleagues that are nice enough to ask me out to play the course, I also don't want to offend them as well. Particularly if they're clients. at some point, I'll probably reveal who I am and how I got onto each of the courses, but probably once I've got the whole thing complete.
Yeah, okay. All right, so well, I'm going to narrow this down. Let's see, we don't know what you do. You live on the East Coast, and we think your name might be Joe. the obvious question for me is, how do you get onto these private courses? You're just a, I hate to use this term, as you're just a blogger, but how do you get onto private courses? Because you've gotten onto some pretty impressive private courses, and you're still planning on doing more.
Yeah, there's a couple ways to get on. So I'll take the obvious ones first. So if you look at the list of the top 100 courses, about a third of them are public courses. So Pebble Beach, certainly Kiawa Island, TPC at Sawgrass. So those aren't difficult. Anybody can get on those. Sometimes it's going to be fairly expensive to get on.
Oh, wait a minute. Wait. I live on the West Coast, and I've tried to get onto Pebble Beach.
Well, you have to.
If you're not staying at the lodge, you know, you get 24 hours notice to try to log into that place.
Mm-hmm.
That's not easy to do.
No, it's not. And if you want to play Beth Page Black and you're not a New York State resident, you have to sleep outside overnight to do that. But, I mean, those are actually, you know, those are difficult to get on in that you have to plan and you potentially have to spend a lot of money. But at least you can get access. You don't have to know a member to get onto those.
Okay.
The courses in the British Isles, which honestly are some of the best in the world. So if you look at, for instance, a course like Royal County Down in Northern Ireland, which is the number 10 ranked course in the world, or even Muirfield or Carnoustie, a lot of these courses, even though they're private courses, they all set out rules where they like to have visitors come over. Now, you have to abide by their rules, so they only allow visitors, let's say, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You have to dress appropriately, and you have to pay a fair amount of money as a greens fee. But the ones in the British Isles, they've got a pretty open approach to this. So as long as you schedule in advance, you can get on to those. The difficult courses to get on are the private courses in the United States. So, for instance, a course like Shinnecock or Marion or Los Angeles Country Club. A lot of the private courses in the United States, you have to know a member or play with a member. So a couple ways that I've been able to get access to those. I mean, the basic way is you have to network. You have to ask people or you have to know a member. I actually went through, I've played 59 of the top 100 so far, and I actually went through and looked at, and only two of those instances did I directly know the member of the course. So a lot of it is just letting people know what you're trying to do, that you'd love to play a particular course. And you'd be surprised as you actually ask around people that, you know, a friend that might know someone that can get you onto a course. It usually works. The other little secret that I'll throw out there for your audience.
Oh, yeah. Give us secrets.
Your golf professional can usually get you on. So if you go to your pro, a PGA pro can call another PGA pro, and, you know, you're not going to get out a group of eight people. You know, usually it's going to be one or two. They'll call the pro at the other club and oftentimes can get you access onto a completely private course. And you still have to pay the greens fee. And, again, you have to respect their rules, and they're probably going to limit the times of day or the days of the week that you can play. So far I've gotten access to, I think, four courses that were otherwise exceedingly difficult to get onto that way. In one instance, I knew someone that knew the architect of one of the top 25 courses and similar type of thing. The architect was able to arrange access for us to get onto that course. And believe it or not, in two instances, and these were both courses ranked in the top 15 in the world, I was just called out of the blue because of my charming website. Someone appreciated my sense of humor, and believe it or not, called, and we arranged it, and I was able to play.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah, which was pretty good. I had not anticipated that. I mean,
no, I know. When you get any recognition off of your website, it's like, oh, my God, it works.
Right. I mean, the point of it, I mean, the blog really grew out of when I would do these trips overseas, I would come back and just sort of write up a summary of the courses we played and what we did. And the people that I play with, you know, really liked that. And it sort of just grew out of that over time.
Sure.
But that's a nice little side benefit thus far.
So give me the most outrageous story that got you onto a course.
The most outrageous. So I'll tell you the one that was very difficult to get on. It was Muirfield in Scotland, which is ranked number 3 in the world. The problem with Muirfield is they want visitors because they charge a very high green fee, and, you know, they use it to help subsidize the course, but they don't really want visitors. So they restrict your play to 2 days a week for about a 4-hour window. So that one, of all the ones in Europe, that one took me about 4.5 years to get on. And you just have to be persistent.
Wow.
You have to ask a lot, and you have to, follow their rules. And then at whatever time they give you to play, you have to just take that. So that one, for instance, we had to book a year in advance and had to build the rest of the trip around that. And that they just have very set rules, and they don't bend them at all. That one has been the one that actually in Europe has been the most difficult.
Interesting. And what is, in your mind so far in the 59 that you've played, what is the best course in the world?
Yeah, I would have to say Sandhills, which is the one in Nebraska. It's located in Mullen, Nebraska, which is a 5.5-hour drive from Denver. It was only built about 12 years ago in 1995. That's probably the best course that I've ever been on. It's an absolutely spectacular golf course. Crenshaw and Kaur, who designed it, designed with a minimalist philosophy. And the course is built in sand dunes, even though you're obviously quite far from any body of water or ocean. There are massive sand dunes, biggest sand dunes I've ever seen. And they just routed the course naturally where the sand dunes were. And it's spectacular. If anyone can go and play Sand Hills, I recommend they rearrange their schedule to go do so. It's the best course I've ever been on.
Thank you for the tip. All right, now let's go on the East Coast. What's the best course?
I would say the best on the East Coast is a course called the National Golf Links of America, which is located in Southampton, New York, which is immediately behind Shinnecock Hills. So Shinnecock, most people have heard of.
Sure.
Great championship course. I've played there as well. Spectacular. But I actually like the National better, which is right behind it. The National was designed by Charles Blair McDonald. He was one of the founders of the USGA. And what he did is he traveled extensively throughout Scotland and England, and he built replica holes of famous courses there. So, for instance, the Alps hole, the Redan hole. So he built 18 replica holes, and this is one of the courses where you're done playing the 18th hole and you want to walk right to the first tee. It's built up on a bluff. It overlooks the bay. You can see Shinnecock and the Shinnecock Clubhouse in the background, and every single hole is unique, and it's a really special place to play golf. That one, and I would say Marion, outside of Philadelphia, is a very good course. The other thing about Marion that's quite good is that's the course that when Bobby Jones won the Grand Slam, that was the fourth course, and he won it on, I think it was the 11th, or yeah, I think the 11th green. So you get chills as you're walking up that hole playing it. So on the East Coast, I would say those are the two. I'm in a bit of a minority. I mean, most people on the East Coast would pick a Winged Foot or a Baltusrol, a lot of the Tillinghast courses. I wasn't really that excited about playing those. They're sort of a lot of holes don't really stand out, a lot of long par fours. Certainly the bunkering is very interesting and the greens are very good, but they're not ones where you walk away and say, wow. Whereas the Marion or a National Golf Links, it really has that wow factor.
Are you not finding wow factor in the Southeast, like Florida or South Carolina? And I mean, where people talk about there's so much golf there.
Yeah, I haven't played Seminole yet, so it's hard to give a full answer on that. But so far, I have not. I've played East Lake, Peachtree in Georgia, a couple other courses in Florida and Carolina. I grew up in the East, the Northeast. I don't particularly like Bermuda grass, and I don't particularly like water. So no, I would say my first choice wouldn't be Florida-style golf course. Although, you know, the courses on the list are very good, but that's just not my personal preference for those types of courses. I like more of a non-traditional design, instead of water on every hole and thick Bermuda grass.
You prefer snow over water?
I don't know. I would say I don't prefer snow.
Come on, you East Coast snobs drive me nuts. I don't know, you got to live in the East. No, you don't. all right, now if we were to go overseas, and let's do the UK, your favorite course.
I would say the best course in Europe is Carnoustie, and most people have a bad opinion of Carnoustie because last time the Open Championship was there, the RNA tricked up the course and made it too narrow. You know, that was the year that Vandeveld had the meltdown. We'll get to see Carnoustie again. The 2007 Open is there. But if you look at just a pure, great golf course, it's Carnoustie. It's not particularly close to the water. There's no great scenery around. It has 18 great holes. What's really interesting about it is the routing is very varied. So in no instance do you play holes that are the same direction into the wind, which is very important in the British Isles because, particularly on the links courses, wind plays a big factor. So it's a very interesting routing, and the finishing holes of 16, 17, and 18 are the toughest and best finish, I think, in all of golf. You have the Barry Byrne, which snakes through the finishing holes on the course, and 18 is the one that everybody remembers when Vandeveld had his meltdown. But 17 is actually a much harder hole because there's little strips of fairway that you have to hit between the snaking burn. So I would say Carnoustie is the best golf course in the British Isles. In terms of the most scenic in the British Isles, I would say it's Royal County Down. Royal County Down is located in Northern Ireland. And people, you know, oftentimes will think, oh, my God, you're crazy. What are you going to Northern Ireland on vacation for? And, you know, that's an old image of Northern Ireland. It's actually one of the most beautiful places in the world. And Royal County Down is set right on the water. And in the background, you've got the Mourne Mountains, which have a sort of purplish hue to them and a quaint little village there. It's a spectacular golf course and really, really scenic and one of the best in the world.
I made a mistake. I forgot to ask you about the West Coast. Now, it's interesting because the West Coast is not just California when you talk about golf courses, because Oregon has definitely made an impact, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I would say the courses in Oregon are as good as they are anywhere in the world.
Wow.
I've played both Bandon Dunes and Pacific Dunes. I was out there before Bandon Trails was built, so I have not played that, but again, those courses were designed. Tom Doak designed one of them. I forget who designed the other. But again, they were designed with the minimalist philosophy, where they didn't overdo it and use the natural contours of the land. And again, they're built on these great sand dunes overlooking the Pacific. Personally, I think they're better than Pebble Beach, and they're more scenic than Pebble Beach. Certainly, the cost is a lot cheaper. The gentleman that designed Bandon Dunes, Mike Kaiser, his whole philosophy was you can't take golf carts. It's the biggest caddy program in the world, apparently. And it's really just built to walk and hit shots and enjoy the environment, and they're both world-class golf courses. So I would say in terms of a golf trip, if any of your listeners wanted to plan a golf trip to the United States, I would make Bandon Dunes, Pacific Dunes, number one on the list ahead of any other destination, Pinehurst, Pebble Beach, anything else. It's got the whole package. Again, like a lot of great courses, it's sort of remote and hard to get to. I think it was a five-hour drive from Portland, but it's worth the effort to get there. I mean, the whole West Coast has really good golf courses. Pebble Beach is a spectacular golf course. And then San Francisco is the only golf course that Tillinghast designed on the West Coast, and I think I've played 8 Tillinghast courses so far. I actually think it's his best design.
And which course is that?
San Francisco Golf Club. It's a private club, so you have to play with a member, but it is a classic Tillinghast course and just really well done. One of his earlier efforts, but very well done. And then the other course that's very good, this one is also private, is Los Angeles Country Club. In Southern California, a lot of the courses were designed by a gentleman by the name of George Thomas. He designed Riviera, Bel Air, and Los Angeles Country Club. And I actually think of the three, even though Riviera oftentimes rates higher, that Los Angeles is a better golf course. Just spectacular views of the city and really good holes. One of the things that I was able to do at Los Angeles Golf Club, which was really is making this whole quest to play these courses much more worthwhile. The gentleman that set me up in the locker room there let me use Ronald Reagan's locker. Reagan was a one-time member of Los Angeles Country Club, and for the day I got to use his locker, which really made it a great day.
That's great.
Yeah, little American flag on top of the locker.
Yeah, right.
So
it's the Ronald Reagan Library, right?
Right.
It's the golf library. Wow. Do you have your own method of judging courses? Do you have a rating system for playability and for scenic beauty and, you know, bunkers and problems and hazards, things like that? Or you just walk away going, I really like that course?
Yeah, I don't have a systematic way to do it. What I find is I like a lot of the older courses that are not straightforward. So I like, for instance, a little bit unconventional, but blind shots I don't mind at all. I like a course that's got a couple of short par fours in it or long par threes. So I would say courses that are a little bit unconventional. I like, so a course like, Baltus Roll or Oak Hill or some of these courses are more of the traditional style where it's almost all a lot of long par fours, which I don't think is that imaginative. So I tend to like ones that are a little bit quirky, but no, I don't have any sort of systematic scale or way to rank them. It's so hard to do because a lot of it is just subjective, the beauty factor and so forth. I try to look past the conditioning. If a course is not in good condition, I'll try to look past that and see whether I would like it or not without that. But that's pretty hard to do.
Yeah, it is, especially when so much
bad condition. Yeah,
it's so when so much of the money now is going into the condition of the course, especially
right.
In resorts and destination courses.
Right.
Do you have one favorite hole in the world that stands out to you?
That's a great question. I would say probably I'll give an answer of two holes, even though I asked for one.
That's okay.
I put the road hole, the 17th hole at the old course, is probably the best hole in the world. It's just a very difficult par four. You have to hit two good shots, and obviously the road hole bunker comes into play. So I would say that's probably best single hole I've played so far.
How'd you do?
I believe I got a bogey on it.
Good for you.
It's an intimidating tee shot because you have to hit over. Your tee shot is over basically the side of a building. The Old Course Hotel has a wing that juts out over the tee box. It's a very intimidating tee shot, so I was actually quite pleased with that. The other hole that I really like is the ninth hole at Royal County Down in Northern Ireland. I'd say it's one of the best and most scenic holes, single holes anywhere in the world.
You're definitely influenced by scenery.
Yeah, it's hard not to be. I mean, when you stand on some of these holes and really look at the mountains and the ocean and the green and the gorse around you, it's really hard not to be impacted by that.
Mm. Well, this is really awesome. And if you want more information or you want to read this blog that Joe writes, go to top100golf.blogspot.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Well, Joe, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Fred. Appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. And you know what? Keep us updated. This is really a great story. We'd love to hear, maybe at the end of each year at the holiday time, we'll wrap up the year and hear what your travels were like for the year. I think that could be a lot of fun.
Would be delighted. Thank you.
Oh, that would be great.
Great.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to you again.
Okay. Take care.
Golf Smarter now presents Nick's Picks with Kenny Nicholson, sales manager for EdwinWattsGolf.com. Kenny keeps us up to date with reviews of new products and new product development. Nick's Picks is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968.
Hey, Kenny, how are you?
Good, Fred. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. You know, last week we started promoting the idea of Ask Kenny. If you have a question about a product or a brand or even a category of products like putters, drivers, et cetera, they would send an email here to Fred at golfsmarterpodcast.com and address it to Ask Kenny. Well, we received a bunch of them. And to each of the people that we use their questions on the show, we're going to send them a Golf Smarter Edwin Watts golf cap. And so I want to ask you a question here that came from Ken Sess in Concord, California. And he talks about new drivers, and he says that new drivers produce many advantages for golfers. He wants to know how he can maximize the benefits and minimize the expense, since he can't afford to have six different brands of shafts, four or five variations of flex, kick point, torque, etc., installed in his driver to see which one works best. Please help. Do you have an answer for this guy?
I actually do. What Ken needs to do is what most golfers that are trying to get fitted for a new driver need to do is visit a local shop or a PGA professional that has a launch monitor, because the big answer to that question is, yes, the shaft is the engine that drives the machine. With the wrong shaft and the right club head, you're not going to have the correct driver for yourself. So regardless of the brand, you need to definitely find one that has the correct launch angle, spin rate, and et cetera. And you can narrow it down to a very specific shaft, not, you know, one, two, or three. You're going to find the shaft that works best for you. You know, we go back to when I went to McGregor and they put me on their launch monitor out there. And, you know, I hit five or six different drivers, and they kept narrowing it down until they find the exact shaft that fit my golf swing. It kept the spin rate where you want it, which is, you know, between 25 and, you know, 3,200 RPMs, and the launch angle between probably 12 and 14 degrees. And then with that, torque is not as much a big issue. You know, they can tell right or left and things of that nature. So I was able to get to the exact shaft that fit my golf swing. And once they mailed it to me and I played it, it was exactly the way it performed on the launch monitor. So the big answer there is yes, you can narrow it down to one or two shafts that fit your golf swing, you know, where you need it. And you don't have to go through all that expense. And the good thing about that is most manufacturers now do not charge an upcharge for a specific shaft. They all have worked with these shaft companies enough, and they offer them for the same price as their stock shafts. So the expense is minimized.
So when you received that club that you had custom fit for yourself, did you see a change in your game at all?
I definitely did. I mean, I was a lot more consistent, you know, because I like most out there, you know, said, hey, this is what I've always played. This is where my swing speed's at, so I should be able to get, you know, this driver with this loft and this shaft and play fairly well with it. And I was able to do that, but whenever I was able to get on a launch monitor and find out exactly what I needed to have for my swing, I definitely increased yardage because, one, you don't have as much backspin, so the ball's getting a little more forward roll. You know, you're hitting it at the correct launch angle to create more distance, and off-center hits were minimized as well. So, yeah, there's a huge difference in being able to get fitted for a shaft that fits your game.
And personally, yardage is nice, but consistency is much more important to me.
Absolutely. Ask any PGA player. They would definitely sacrifice yardage to be able to hit more fairways. I know I would.
Well, that's great. That was a good question. Thank you. Again, that came from Ken Sess of Concord, California. He will be the first person on the planet to have a Golf Smarter Edwin Watts golf cap. We'll send that out to him. Do you mind? There's a second question that I'm really intrigued about, because we talked about those new shoes in the last episode. We've actually talked about shoes a couple episodes in a row, and someone sent a question. Do you mind if I ask you another question?
No, not at all.
Okay, this one comes from Rich Chopiak of Longmont, Colorado, and he mentions the discussion about shoes, and he was looking for good job, Rich, I love this. I'm looking for something to convince me that golf shoes are a necessity. I've never used golf shoes because I just haven't seen that much of a benefit in them. I've asked friends who use them. None of them have said they really make that much of a difference. Because of that, I haven't been willing to spend the money. What are the benefits? How helpful are they really? It seems like a good, comfortable pair of athletic shoes with a good sole would be more comfortable and usable off the golf course as well. What do you say to that?
Well, two things real quick. One, I've always been told that a good practice method is to go without golf shoes on the driving range.
Really?
Whether you go barefoot. Yeah, one, because you have to swing within yourself. You know, you can't go after a shot without golf shoes. One, because they provide so much traction you can go after it, and if you don't have golf shoes on, your feet are going to slide from underneath you. So if you have a problem with rhythm, one good way to take care of that is to actually try to practice with you know, barefooted or with, you know, some type of tennis shoe with not as much traction on the bottom of them. Comfort's another thing there. A lot of people find traditional golf shoes to not be very comfortable. That's why a lot of the manufacturers have made a tennis shoe-style golf shoe. I think it is an absolute necessity, especially where we're at in the Southeast, where you get a lot of moisture and stuff on the golf course. Your feet are going to slide from under you. So especially if you have a downhill or an uphill lie, traction is a key thing there. So, one, no golf shoes are fine because those people tend to swing within themselves. They don't, you know, try to go after as many shots as somebody that has golf shoes. But golf shoes are a necessity because they do allow you more traction on the golf course. And I, you know, we'll say this: there was a guy on the Big Break that played, you know, a few seasons ago, whatever it was. He played barefooted on the Big Break and was one. I think he was one of the finalists.
Really,
the guy played, you know, was out there barefooted while everybody else had golf shoes on. So to each his own. But
they must have loved that. They were probably focused on his feet all the time.
You're right. But the guy's a great player. But you know, he definitely you definitely stay within yourself when you do not have golf shoes on.
And. Well, you know, also they went from the metal cleats to the plastic cleats now, the soft spikes. And has that, I know that the people who do the maintenance and stuff, that's made them very happy, right? It's, it just puts less damage on the course?
It has. And the key thing there was, you know, again, goes back to traction, where they're able to create a soft spike shoe that benefited like a metal spike shoe did. And there are several different manufacturers out there that make spikes that do grip very, very well. There's, you know, a lot of PGA pros are apprehensive to still switch to that to this day.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a ton that still, I don't know what the percentages are, but there's a bunch that still wear metal spikes.
Hmm. I don't know. There's something about the sound of metal spikes when you're walking on cement that just... It brings back Little League to me, but that's it.
It brings back me going to the golf course with my dad, or you know, just that sound going to a baseball game.
It's a great sound.
It is, you know.
It's a classic sound. There's nothing quite like metal spikes on cement.
You're correct.
Thank you for those questions, and keep them coming. Let's move on now to our giveaway. And we've been talking for the last couple of weeks, because it's perfect for the holiday season, a drawing for a U.S. Kids Junior set. And we've received 57 entries, and I've sorted them by city, so it really doesn't matter when they've come in. And I would like for you to pick a number between 1 and 57, and you can choose 1 or 57. And the winner of the U.S. Kids Junior Golf Set is...
Number 25.
Number 25 is Bill Woodhull of Laga Vista, Texas. And... Actually, I got to tell you, I've been keeping some of the notes here of what people have written to us. And here's what Bill wrote. And Bill, I hope you don't mind that I'm saying this, but I'm really excited to be giving this to you. It says, for my 12-year-old daughter or 14-year-old son with Downs, they're both right-handed. So congratulations, Bill. Happy holidays to you and your family. We'll be getting those out to you real soon.
Congratulations, Bill.
That's awesome. But we need to now give away something else. We have another drawing. Deadline will be December 25th to get the entries in, and we'll do the drawing. I'm going to have to track you down on December. Are you working December 26th?
I will actually be working the 26th, yes.
Okay. Well, you'll be working for me that day.
I know I will.
So we can do the drawing then. What are we going to give away next?
Rich's question is perfect for a giveaway. We're going to actually give away a pair of FootJoy Real Fit golf shoes, one of the most technologically advanced shoes on the market right now. So hopefully, Rich, put your name in.
Oh, he will. He always does. He's been a regular, and we appreciate that. But these are the shoes that we talked about in the last episode with the BOA technology, right? That you don't have to tie the shoes?
Yeah, that's correct. New patented BOA technology. So, and I've got a pair myself, and will tell you, they are unbelievable.
And these are not inexpensive shoes.
They are not. The MSRP on them is $200, so it's not a cheap pair of golf shoes.
This is awesome. So make sure when you send your entry in, tell us what size shoe you are and if you're a man or a woman, right?
Yeah, we'll be able to take care of some color variations there as well as size. So just, you know, whoever wins the shoes, they can tell us afterwards what size and color they want to go with, and we'll set them up with what they need.
Awesome. All right. Well, to win, please send an email with the subject FootJoy to pickme@golfsmarterpodcast.com. And along with your email address, please include your name and mailing address so that we know where to send the prize when you win. For more information, of course, check the show notes. And as a disclaimer to let you know, all as always, when you enter, your email address will be provided to Edwin Watts Golf. It's not that big a deal. Again, midnight December 25th is your entry deadline. Also, December shopping special, 10% off of any purchase. You got a couple weeks left, and this is the buying time. Some restrictions apply, obviously. So go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the link to Edwin Watts Golf. It'll take you directly to the Golf Smarter page with full instructions on how to obtain your 10% discount on any item. Restrictions apply, and your free shipping. Kenny, I think that about wraps it up for us today.
Sounds good, Fred.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you next week.
You got it.
I haven't asked you a whole lot to do this, but I really would appreciate if you have a review of the Golf Smarter podcast and say you download the show from iTunes, can you please go into iTunes and put a review for us in there? It really does make a difference. It keeps us on the front page in the sports, which is pretty outrageous that we are. And if you happen to be at the Golf Smarter podcast page and you see a listener survey, I would also appreciate if you can fill that out. Anything that we can get, any feedback at all that we can get here, I can make adjustments to the program to suit your needs, and I really do pay attention to that stuff. And if you've been listening for the past year, you'd notice that we have been making those changes. Are you in need in the ultimate golf learning experience with ultimate instructors, ultimate courses, ultimate accommodations that garner ultimate results? Then you need to check out the Bird Golf Academy. There are schools in 8 states that are easy to access from anywhere in the United States. To find out more, go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the link to birdgolf.com. We end with our quote of the week, which is submitted by you. If you have a favorite golf quote, send an email with the subject quote to fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com. And this week's quote comes from Rob Capozzello of Charlotte, North Carolina, who quotes radio announcer Paul Harvey, who says, "Golf is a game in which you yell 4, shoot 6, and write down 5. Good day. Thanks for listening to the Golf Smarter Podcast. I'm Fred Green.